us from the jungle.
WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for April 30th, 2025. More support for affordable housing in Sarasota may be on the way. Perhaps responding to the latest negative report on the area's affordable housing crisis, the Sarasota County Commission seems ready to consider some of the most aggressive policies proposed to remedy the situation, including using a percentage of rising property tax income from new development as an ongoing source of revenue for the county's Affordable Housing Trust Fund, according to the Sarasota Herald Tribune. That idea was proposed by Local Affordable Housing Advisory Committee member Drayton Saunders, president of Michael Saunders and Company, the largest real estate brokerage in the region, and is strongly backed by the Greater Sarasota Chamber of Commerce. I was overwhelmed with the positivity, John Thaxton, AHAC's chair, said of the board's reaction to his presentation and recommendations. Lawsuit against FEMA has been dropped. A lawsuit filed by Florida accusing the former Federal Emergency Management Agency head and FEMA supervisor of discriminating against supporters of then-presidential candidate Donald Trump during relief efforts following Hurricanes Helene and Milton was settled this week, as reported in the Florida Phoenix. The action resulted from the FEMA supervisor advising relief workers in Lake Placid in Highlands County to avoid houses displaying yard signs favoring Trump. Florida Attorney General James Altmaier agreed to drop the suit in exchange for a letter of apology from the federal government, according to court documents. Dina Criswell, the former FEMA head, didn't admit wrongdoing, and the letter directs responsibility to Marnie Washington, the supervisor. As part of the settlement, Criswell and the state agreed to pay their own attorney's fees, and Altmaier has also dropped the claims against Washington. U.S. consumer confidence plunges to its lowest point in 5 years on tariff worries. According to the Associated Press, consumer confidence in the United States has fallen for the fifth straight month to its lowest level since the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. This time, the man-made crisis of worldwide tariffs is rocking expectations for future growth. The Conference Board said Tuesday that its consumer confidence index fell 7.9% in April to 86, its lowest reading since May 2020. This has been Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for April 30th, 2025.
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. John Dickman is here helping out on the boards, and thank you, John. Let me remind you that the views and opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. My guest today is Seth Stottlemyer. His book is called Pathway to a New American Future, Our Best Chance for a National Reset. Seth's parents, Steve and Terry, have long been supporters of WSLR, and we appreciate that. But welcome, Seth.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm happy to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, I really enjoyed your book. I read the whole thing, one of the first times. So I review books here. Usually I don't read every page, but this was very good, very conversational, very educational.
Thank you.
First, before we start on your book, tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, your education, your family, all that stuff.
So I was born in Highlands, North Carolina. My parents moved up there in the 70s, and my family is all from they grew up in Sarasota, and they moved up there in the mid-70s. And so I went to school primarily up there. For a period of time, I was back down in Sarasota going to school. And that's actually where I met my wife, Allison. We were in middle school together and then lost touch for a while and then reconnected later on in life. And so I ended up actually back in North Carolina, graduated from high school. I went to Appalachian State University. in Boone, North Carolina. And after school, I ended up back in Sarasota helping out with my family's business. My dad had opened up a gas station convenience store on Fruitville Road and in 1996. And that's actually on that same property. He subsequently opened up Stottlemyre Smokehouse. Go ahead.
Right. No, that's a great place.
Yeah. We have a lot of local support for that, a lot of great live music. But for 10 years, I was involved with the convenience store, and that was a really good learning experience. I got a lot of business background. And then my wife and I reconnected. She was living in New York City, actually. And so I moved up to be with her in 2010. Mm. We did 5 years up there. Had a great time. A lot of interesting opportunities. I've worn a lot of different hats in terms of my career. I've had a lot of different interests. I actually have always had an interest in plants and landscaping, and I started taking classes at New York Botanical Garden, signed on with a high-end gardening company, ended up being one of their foremen, and I worked on rooftop gardens all over New York City.
Oh, great.
And that was quite an experience. Got to see some very interesting and beautiful real estate in New York City, and we just had a really good time up there. Had a great network of friends, but it was time to come home. Our parents live down here in Sarasota. We wanted to get back down to Sarasota and be near my dad and my stepmom. My mom actually still lives in North Carolina, but she's actually down here visiting right now.
Cool.
And Allison's parents were down here, so we wanted to get back here. And so anyway, we moved back in 2015. Eleanor was born in 2018, and so that's our 7-year-old daughter, and she is the light of our life and an inspiration, and keeps us both going and active on a daily basis. So,
well, that's great. So you're kind of local and kind of not. You've been all over, and now you're back.
That's right.
So tell us about this book. The book is called Pathway to a New American Future: Our Best Chance for a National Reset.
Right.
How did the idea in the book originate with you?
Well, I've always had an interest in writing and reading. Books have always been an important part of my life. Even while I had different careers I was involved in, I always had an instinct, I think, to kind of express myself, and I've never been short of opinions in terms of, you know, speaking out in terms of what I think is right and wrong. And my parents instilled a real strong instinct as far as that goes. You know, just touching back again on my family's background, they've been here since the 50s and the 60s, but been really involved in the community. Before my dad was an entrepreneur in business, he was heavily involved as an attorney in helping to integrate Sarasota schools, public schools, and working with Booker School. My mom was an English teacher. Mm-hmm. My aunt, Jean Shoemaker, she was integral in starting Planned Parenthood in Sarasota here.
Wow.
My uncle Charlie, who just recently passed away, was a real community leader and was one of the initial founders getting the YMCA started. So I've kind of got that background of public service, even though I haven't officially ever myself been involved with politics or public policy. So this book, you know, it basically, I consider it kind of a love letter to my country. I started to get really concerned, you know, back in the mid 2000s, with the rise of Trump and Trumpism. I saw what was happening, and honestly, it sent a shiver down my spine, you know. And I think we were all kind of watching this and trying to figure out, how is it possible that somebody, you know, for me, it's kind of a simple thing. You know, how can you support a con artist, a convicted felon, a serial bankruptcy artist, a sex offender, and then subsequently, after his first term at the end, you know, somebody who refused to accept the legitimate results of an election, Democratic election. And that basically kind of turned our world upside down. But my overall, you know, concern, the creeping authoritarianism and the normalization of violent rhetoric, and even tolerance of violence, I really started to look around, and I think we all saw it in our own personal lives and our families and with our friends, you know, started to feel like the fabric of American society kind of ripping. and shredding. And so the book was kind of inspired by what is it? How can I kind of put a whole arc on, you know, we have such a great country. We have so much potential.
Right.
But there are some really dark forces at work that we have to grapple with. And, you know, but there's so many issues that we actually agree upon. There are things that, you know, if the politicians, you know, candidly on the left and the right, you know, there's extremism on both sides. And I'll say the extremism is, from my personal standpoint, a lot more threatening from the far right now in terms of, you know, the creeping fascism that we're seeing in authoritarianism. But, there's a real issue in terms of what is going to happen. And I think people, you know, started to get a lot of anxiety, and I just felt like there's needs to be some sort of book that can be written in a conversational sense.
Yep.
That's approachable, that is not overly academic, that can kind of like get people back on track and focus their attention going forward on the things that really matter.
Yeah, I love the conversational. It's like talking to somebody. I really love the book in that sense, the conversational sense. And let me read you just four quotes that I loved from the very first 10 or 12 pages. You said your goal is to break out of the cycle of negativity and animosity we're stuck in. You said, we aren't as different from each other as we think, which I believe is true. You said, most of us are not hardcore, but relatively moderate. That's on page six.
Right.
And then apathy and ignorance of issues kill democracies. Of course. And we're seeing that. So
right.
Let's talk about some of the pathways. Like you say, there's about 10 different major pathways you propose.
Sure.
Pick one and let's talk about it.
Well, you know, I think the kind of the linchpin of everything right now, we do agree on more than we disagree on. There are the big issues, but in terms of getting legislation passed, mm-hmm. It seems, you know, Sisyphusian that we can't, you know, trying to roll the rock up the hill.
Right.
Seems almost impossible with the two-party system that we're dealing with. Mm. You know, everybody's got the Republican label or a Democratic label, and that immediately a lot of times shuts down conversation. Mm-hmm. And the system that we're currently working with, members of Congress in almost every district across the country they have to work with the closed primary system. And the closed primary system, basically all it does is incentivize them to speak to the far right or their far left bases just to get through the primary. And their main focus, you know, is honestly just about raising money. Then when they actually get to Congress, they're not incentivized anymore to work together. All they're incentivized to do is to kind of like create outrage on their TikTok or their social media, their YouTube channels, and to just raise money for the next election.
More money. Yep.
Right. They're not trying to, you know, build coalitions to try to, you know, compromise. And the thing that we've forgotten about these days in this zero-sum political environment is that, you know, it is supposed to be about compromise and working together. Neither side is necessarily going to get everything they want. So the open primary and ranked choice election, that's kind of it's not my first chapter, but I put it in there. It is the linchpin to everything, because if we can have a situation where candidates, I'll just quickly describe what an open primary and ranked choice election is. It starts with an open primary. So everybody, no matter what their political angle is, they're in the primary from the beginning. And so everybody gets to vote. Let's just say, and New York uses this for mayor. Alaska's used it. Some places in Minnesota, right? Maine, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yep. And, so let's say there's seven people running for a particular office. And so that everybody's allowed to vote for everybody right from the beginning. The top four win. The top four go to the general election. Then everybody in the general election, you rank your candidates. So 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the last candidate, if nobody gets 50%, then you go to another round. So let's say you've ranked your candidates 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's say your last candidate, or your top candidate was the one that got the least amount of votes.
So he's eliminated.
So they're eliminated. So your second choice candidate gets your vote then.
So that, your vote still counts just for your second choice.
That's exactly right. So the system just kind of automatically moves through rounds. Usually a winner, shows itself in the second round, but it could go to a third or fourth round.
But there's a guaranteed winner of more than 50%
at
the end of that process.
That's exactly right. And the biggest benefit to the open primary situation is that all the candidates, they're motivated to speak to the entire electorate. They're not just speaking to one side or the other. Because they're trying to like garner as much goodwill with the overall population and voters. And they're also, there's still going to be some political aspects involved, and they're going to go after their candidates to some extent to look better in the race. But they're also not going to be as negative.
Right. They want some of the second choices.
That's right. They want to be everybody's second choice. And so the whole idea is that the candidates are speaking to, the entire electorate from the beginning. So they're motivated to cooperate and work together. So when you do have a winner in that race and they go to Washington, D.C., those people that have gone through the open primary ranked choice process are motivated to work across the aisle. They're motivated. And, eventually, to be perfectly honest with you, my voting kind of preferences, more aligned with the Democratic Party, but I am a registered non-party affiliation. But, those preferences for me basically come down to the fact that women's reproductive rights are key for me. The environment, social justice, staying in NATO and working with our NATO Western Democratic allies. So it's kind of not very difficult for me to vote for that one side. But the point is that, eventually, maybe, we can get rid of the, I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but this can get us more towards a situation where we don't have as much antagonism and acrimony in the country just based on this bankrupt two-party system.
Right. And we'll talk about the Electoral College, which is for the president, the vice president, of course, separately. But some states have already done this, and it would take – in Florida, I believe it would take a change to the Constitution by the legislature to make that happen. And some people remember on this show many years ago, we had the people who were working for the idea of just – let's just have local elections here in Sarasota City, ranked choice voting, right? And the citizens put it, they put it on the ballot, and it passed.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed the city charter, and then so the state legislature didn't like that, and they passed a law that said you can't even do it in local city elections.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Yes.
And that's because of the vested interests, of the two-party system. The fundraising apparatuses. Their whole situation is set up basically to continue to perpetuate the status quo.
And then the open primaries in the sense that independents like you could go in and ask for either a Democratic ballot or Republican ballot, not both, of course, and vote the way they wanted to in the primaries would open things up and give more voices.
Right.
But they're usually closed because there's somebody who will jump in and run from the other side to close it off to just Republicans or just Democrats.
Right.
That needs fixing. I agree with you.
I think there are big hurdles to getting it done, but if everybody continues to talk about it, and I think if there's one thing we can all agree upon in this country right now, that everybody is tired of the way it is.
Yes.
Don't we want to start to try to make some changes and do some bold things? So I think this is like an actual systematic structural way to do that.
Yes. Okay. How about some more bold things in your book? Your book is full of them. It's amazing. Go ahead.
So, I'll be the first to say that, none of these ideas that I'm putting forth in these chapters, not my original ideas, but there are things that are out there that have gotten lost in all the noise of the culture wars and all that. So my goal is to get people back on track and looking at things and opportunities to kind of create more unity in the country. So the Electoral College, let's just go ahead and start with that and piggyback off of that. Obviously, it's a ridiculous concept. It's antiquated. One vote should count for one vote, whether you're in the state of Wyoming or California or New York State or wherever. Your vote shouldn't count two and a half times.
So just national popular vote.
National popular vote. I think it's ridiculous, kind of how it's gone the situations where one party has clearly won the national popular vote. The sentiment of the overall country is right. to go in one direction, but then the other candidate wins. So right. I think it's a ridiculous, antiquated system, and it can actually trip up. You know, I think we were both kind of surprised. We were all surprised and shocked that Trump won the popular vote this time too, assuming that everything was on the up and up, which I am.
You didn't get a majority; you got a plurality.
That's a good point. That's a very good point, Tom. But you know, I never thought. I was like, okay, he can thread the needle; he can win the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. There's no way he's going to win the popular vote. So mm-hmm. we'll always be able to, you know, have that to be able to say, listen, the majority of the country, you know, was still against him, and in the end, the majority is, you know, against his policies. So. You know, the Electoral College is definitely one of those things that I think, and it's another difficult, you know, thing to kind of work through, but I think we can do it. Another issue, is a chapter that I think is really important, and it has a lot of potential to change the tone and tenor of the country, and that's mandatory national service.
Okay.
All right. So, I didn't serve in the military, and sometimes I feel like maybe I should have, you know.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know if you've ever – did you serve?
No, I did not. They were not taking men with children.
Well.
You know? And so I said, okay.
Yeah. Well, I certainly could have. I chose the path of just – you know, I always thought I was just going to go to college, and that's what I did. But I've always had an incredible amount of respect for service members and the armed service. I've had lots of members of my family that have served in the Army – and National Guard and all of that. And I think it's really important. You know, what Israel does in terms of their national service, without going into great detail, you know, everybody has to serve in the actual armed services, right?
What is 2 years?
2 years, 3 years or something, right?
Yeah.
So what I don't propose a system just like that, but I do think that we should move towards a situation where we have mandatory service for everybody, say between the ages of 16 and 18. And you wouldn't necessarily have to serve in the Army. You could serve in civil service. You could.
Didn't we used to have AmeriCorps?
A similar system to AmeriCorps and a program like that. You know, you could serve in national parks. You could help out feeding the poor, in you know, across your community. You could do all sorts of issues in terms of social justice and humanitarian work. But it wouldn't necessarily, if you wanted to serve in the Army, you could. But the idea with the mandatory national service, and obviously kids would be going to school, when I say kids, teenagers would be going to school. A lot of the service would happen, you know, a few weekends of the year.
Right.
During the summer.
Like the National Reserve.
Like a National Reserve thing. But the idea is shared sacrifice. We've forgotten about this idea of shared sacrifice. You know, the socioeconomic differences within our country have grown so big.
And to meet people outside your bubble, you know.
Exactly. So it would force, you know, people from different backgrounds. Kids from the inner city would be, you know, all of a sudden serving with farm boys from Iowa. And, you know, the idea is to bring everybody together to remember that we're different, but we're working towards the same goals. You know, we want the same things. We want, you know, prosperity for our country. We want prosperity for our families. We want safety. We want, you know, a brighter future. But right now we're just so divided. So that would be like, it would be a great thing for the country, but in terms of what it could do to help heal the social fabric, I think that's a good one.
Yeah. And by the way, you wonder who we're talking to. We're talking to local author Seth Stottlemyre about his book, Pathway to a New American Future, Our Best Chance for a National Reset. And the link to his book and some words about his book are on the front page of WSLR.org. And he has a blog you can go to and so forth. So that's Seth Stottlemyre. Okay, Seth, what else do you have there?
So another chapter, I deal with the single-payer healthcare issue. So I think, you know, it's very complicated. It's obviously the most kind of policy and wonky in the weeds kind of subject that I could, you know, probably put in the book. But on, you know, on a basic level, you know, we spend twice as much as, you know, most of the top Western Democratic allies, in Europe and including Japan. And what kind of health outcomes do we have? What is our satisfaction with the service that we're getting? Now, obviously, the top 10% in this country, wealth-wise, they can get any kind of health care they want.
Concierge physician, no big deal.
At any point, you know, for any sort of ailment or thing they want to do. But what are the health outcomes and results in the quality for the vast majority of Americans? And the truth is, it's not very good. You know, we have the insurance companies, which it's its own kind of entitled industry, and they are the middlemen, and they have such a huge effect on what we're actually paying at the doctor's offices or at the hospital for stays or surgical procedures. They push the prices up, and you know, most of the countries, you know, whether it's Germany or England or Denmark or Belgium, on and on and on, they're generally very satisfied with their health
for a lot less
healthcare, and literally the amount that they're spending on it as a country per person per capita is about half.
Yes.
And sometimes it's even less than half.
Yeah.
So I just think it would behoove all of us if, you know, we've dealt with this. We've been going back and forth with it. We got Obamacare. You know, that was great in terms of it, guaranteeing pre-existing conditions and all that. But what was the biggest failure of Obamacare? The biggest failure of Obamacare was they didn't put in the price controls.
Right.
So immediately, you know, the legislation passed. And you know, the next year, all the health insurance went up 10%. Then the next year was up 15%, et cetera, et cetera. So we didn't really get any cost benefits out of that legislation. You know, maybe some people would have different opinions on that. But anyway, I think there's a lot of potential with that one to basically, you know, again, it's one of these things that creates a little bit more unity and equality in America. Yes. And in an environment that has become very unequal.
Yes. And there's a book I'm going to send you that I read. Came out a few years ago. It went to every country in the world, Western and industrial country, and explained their system and how they arrived at it. There were a couple, Taiwan and Switzerland, I think, that switched from private like ours, mm-hmm, to publicly supported health care in the last 10, 15 years. So it can be done. And a lot of these retained the insurance companies, but they just made them nonprofit, if you know what I mean, the controls on the costs and the prices. So it can be done. Mm-hmm. And it's done all over the world. And we're one of the few that have not.
Absolutely,
done it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're talking to Seth Stottlemyre about his book, Pathway to a New American Future, Our Best Chance for a National Reset. Talk about some more resets.
Oh, let's see. Where can we go? There's just lots of opportunity, lots of different directions we can go. You know, another one that's obviously we just dealt with the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. And I think, you know, we've had a lot of gut punches in over the last 10 years, and we've been drinking from a fire hose for the last 100 days, obviously trying to get our footing. But, you know, during the last administration, the Supreme Court reversed Roe versus Wade, and I think a woman's right to control her own body,
yes,
has to be one of the most fundamental, you know, freedoms and rights that there are. The fact that, you know, we had Roe, and it was established law, and even the justices that you know overturned it, you know, basically they were dishonest with us in
yes,
the hearings,
they were, yeah.
And they said they wouldn't touch established precedent and law, and that was one of the ones. Oh well, no, you know, of course they just stonewalled in the hearings, and then they got in there, and that was the agenda all along. But I think it really was a shock to all of us, you know. But I think until we can restore a woman Roe or legislation some sort of legislation like that, or a ruling is affirmed by the Supreme Court, and we can get actual legislation passed on a national level, guaranteeing a woman's right to control her own body and reproductive freedom, I really feel that it's sending the message to women across the country and young girls that they are second-class citizens.
Sure.
And I come from a my family. We have a. I have four sisters.
Yeah.
And I have an incredible mother. I have an incredible stepmother. I have a mother in love, as I call her, and they are all very strong women. My four sisters are all younger than I am. Three of them are attorneys.
Wow.
And the other one is incredibly brilliant and engaged in all sorts of philanthropic work and social justice stuff. And they all are. And they are very tough and very strong. And I think about them all the time in terms of what they, what they're, the message they're being sent by their government and by the Supreme Court that, you know, they are second class citizens. Essentially, they don't get to ultimately control their own body. And what we're seeing across in all these states that, in states like Texas and Alabama, where they have basically, taken that ruling by the Supreme Court and they're actually persecuting doctors and women that are trying to cross state lines to just basically get, medical procedures. It's not abortion is not birth control. You know, it's, I understand it's a very personal issue. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but it is women's health care.
Yes.
And that's the thing that we have to remember. And, you know, you're entitled to your own, feeling about it because of religious beliefs and all that. And I respect that. But that doesn't mean
your choice. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you get to tell my wife
right.
or my sister or my daughter what she gets to do with her body.
Right.
So.
But, you know, we had a organization on the program not too long ago called Elevated Access, and it's a whole group of private pilots who will fly someone who needs abortion care anonymously out of the state, halfway across the country, to Elevated Access to get the care they need. And then flies them back, no charge.
Right.
So, and that's just one of the tiny little ways other people are trying to help remedy this situation.
Right. So. Right. So, I mean, I think that's a critical issue. Obviously, in this current administration and with this current makeup of the Supreme Court, we're not going to get there, in the short term, but we have to continue to fight back. It's
yes.
like all the issues we have to continue to fight back. The rollback of environmental protection issues, we have to continue to fight back against that. Voting rights issues. This is a real test for us. So,
all right. Well,
where else do you want to go? Do you want to go?
I want to talk about kids.
You
have a chapter on digital and social media education
sure.
for kids and teens. You have kids. I want to know what you think the social media does to them, their anxiety and their self-image. And also, I want to know, just whether it's good for them, and if they do use social media, how can we educate them to use it better, or teach them a little bit more history and
sure.
perspective?
Sure, I think we need to be raising kids in a general sense to be able to be good consumers and smart consumers of digital media, and it starts at a young age, and so you kind of got two issues: that the content that they're actually consuming,
yeah.
As they progress, in age, whether it's appropriate and so forth. And then there's also just the amount of time that kids are obviously spending on it. For our family, we have a 7-year-old daughter and she, has her pad and she has it for learning purposes, but also there's, the Disney app on there and
yeah.
there's the PBS Kids app, which is pretty good. I try to steer her towards
good
that
idea.
More than anything.
Yeah.
But then there's also kind of some ridiculous, useless games. But, we're a reading family. So we really, and Eleanor loves to read. So we're trying to continue to foster that and continue to, push her towards books. So we on a daily basis, we limit the screen time. But, as kids get older, the digital media and all the social media apps, whether it's Instagram and WhatsApp and, all the other ones that I am already feeling, as a 49-year-old father, way too old to completely understand. they're all very distracting and they're also, can be pretty destructive,
Yes.
They can very quickly ruin a kid's life.
Yes.
If obviously it raises anxiety levels. There's been studies about that. And then also just, you know, it kind of like supercharges, you know, bullying tendencies in, yes. in high schools and so on. So I think there needs to be more of a focus of that in public education, public schools, and whether it's a charter school or a private school, I think there should be more courses taught on that, focusing on, you know, being able to be good consumers. And also as they get older, obviously we've dealt with a lot of misinformation in our news, over the last 10 years. What's true? What's false? What's real news? What's quote fake news? I think they need to be able to be more taught to be more discerning. They need more tools to be able to like figure out, well, you know, what's true and what's not. And, you know, what are their elected officials? What are the candidates telling them? Can they be trusted? You know, and it is more and more challenging these days, obviously with deep fakes and the videos that can be produced AI. You know, overlaying voices over videos and images. So it is more challenging than ever. But I think it's up to public policy people to kind of make that a priority, because it literally, you know, in many ways, what happened on Facebook during the 2006, starting in 2015, 2016, the amount of misinformation that was, you know, fed to us and that people actually consumed and believed, it has come close to tearing us apart as a country. And so how do we fix that?
It's a big issue. Placed there by other countries too. You know,
right.
We got to teach literacy and being able to discern. We're talking to Seth Stottlemyre about his book, Pathway to a New American Future, Our Best Chance for a National Reset. Seth Stottlemyre, there is a new book I sent you a link to called The Anxious Generation, and it's all about social media for teenagers and preteens. And he has some solutions and some documentation of the harms. And I think it's a great book. I'm halfway through it now on Kindle. Okay. Wow, we've got a lot of pathways to improving ourselves here.
So somebody's asked me a question about term limits and my opinion on that. You know, just to circle back to the you know, the political and electoral system that we deal with and so forth. I think I'm kind of two minds on the issue of term limits. So I think in some ways term limits could be beneficial if they are reasonable term limits. Some people are like, oh, we should, you know, only 6 years and we should kick the bums out and then get a new batch in. I think we need to have, I think there's got to be some reasonable time periods. You know, if there's something to be said for experience and knowledge that is acquired, how to pass laws and for congressmen and congresswomen to be actually get their feet underneath them and become skilled and effective legislators. So, you know, maybe 12 years or something like that for members of Congress. You know, and so people can't necessarily make a 30-year career out of it. But they're there long enough to get good at what they're doing and become effective. And I think if you were to kind of marry that with the idea of open primaries and ranked choice elections, where you're actually getting, you know, if we can get the courage, you know, across the country in different states to allow for that process to happen, and we get those sorts of lawmakers into Washington, D.C. that actually care about, you know, reaching across the aisle and compromising and cooperating to get things done for all of Americans, then I think that combined with term limits could be a very effective 1-2 punch to improve things.
It'd be interesting to try to pick that limit. The Florida legislature has one now, and they have to leave, like Anna Eskamani over in Orlando. They had to leave just as she was one of the most expert and knowledgeable people I've ever heard talk about the legislative process, and she has to leave.
She's the state legislature?
The state, yeah.
What are the term limits now?
Oh, I think it's like 8 years. It might be a little bit more. Sorry, I don't know. Anyway, so there's a limit.
Right. And 8 years, I think, is too little.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for a governor, I think two terms, so it's effectively 8 years. Then that, I agree with that, obviously. But
and then, of course, governors can be reelected. Congressmen at present can be reelected forever. You know, it's And they accumulate staff and knowledge, you know.
Right, right.
So we want to be careful how we do that, of course. But how about let's talk about another one of your ideas is a national civics curriculum. Learn about
sure.
Or did we already?
We did not touch on that one yet. But it in some ways, you know, ties in with the media education and all that. So obviously, you know, civics is taught. I mean, when I was in school, in high school, in grade school, you know, civics was really important. I feel like it's been put on the back burner. You know, I don't have the exact stats in terms of the classes and courses.
It's not much. I looked it up yesterday. It's not much in Florida.
They've kind of marginalized
yeah.
it, right?
Yeah.
And it's more about obviously math and science, which
yeah.
is really important. We've got to really focus on that. We have to get our technical skills as a country up, but we also have to understand our history as a country, you know, and what got us here and
how it works,
how it all works. And I think that the current generation of students are less aware about the history of the United States and how government works than ever before.
It's pathetic. Some people can't even tell you the three branches of government. And
right.
And, yet,
and they don't understand that they're co-equal.
Right. Yeah.
Supposedly.
And there's one particular person I'm thinking of that doesn't understand that.
That's exactly right.
Yes, we need more of that. And that would probably help them become better voting citizens.
I think, you know, the one way to do it, and it's not going to happen, obviously, under this administration. So this is something that we're going to have to continue to, you know, talk about, and people that are educators and care about civics and teaching kids about the history of the United States, they're going to have to continue to push forward. But the idea that you can tie federal – this is, in my mind, one way to do it. You can tie federal education money to a mandated national standardized curriculum for national civics.
Or maybe increase the money as they do it better.
Sure.
No, that's a great idea.
Sure. But it should be – there should be designated courses – you know, and I think there may be some actual civics courses that are offered, but, or there may be touched on in other courses, but I don't think it's given, enough attention. I know it's not given enough attention, and kids are coming out just kind of like, I don't know. Are we a democracy, mom and dad, or
do they vote? And sometimes they
yeah.
end up as non-voters. Yeah.
Right. So I think you could use the national education funds to kind of motivate states, let's just say. But obviously under this current administration that's, you know, bandied about threatening to close down the Department of Education and has basically elected or appointed the CEO of the WWE.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Worldwide wrestling.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like we're taking education too seriously for the next 4 years on the national level.
So the states can do better than that. Florida has a one semester minimum, I think, for middle school students and an optional one for high school students. It's just not much.
I
could be wrong, but I tried to look it up. It's not much there. Well, we've got a couple more things we could talk about. That's the beauty of your book. You talk about each one of these in a thorough way, in a conversational way, to put our minds, make us think.
It's kind of in some ways, it's the kitchen sink, but
yes.
it's the kitchen
no,
sink
no.
of
it's fun.
Of big opportunities.
Yes,
you fun. Know, these are the things, you know, these things, if you look at them as a whole, these are the prescriptions for what ails us as a country. You know, we are going to have to get past this period right now of creeping authoritarianism, and in some ways it seems like increasingly daily blatant authoritarianism. But I think if we can get past that, and I'd like to in a little bit maybe talk about some of the ways we you know that we're going to have to kind of you know rally and fight back. But
yeah.
I think that the opportunities are huge to still be the country that I think all of us when we were growing up thought that we were living in, you know, the land of opportunity, equality for all, If you work hard and you play by the rules, that, you know, you can create a great life for yourself, right, and for your family. And I think we can get back to that in a greater sense of unity, but it will take, breaking down, you know, getting past this period and also breaking down a lot of the systems and entrenched interests that, are fighting against that. Tom, if I could, I one other issue that I think is pretty important that I wouldn't mind touching on.
Sure.
That, obviously has definitely gone in another direction recently is, comprehensive immigration reform.
Oh, yeah.
It used to be a bipartisan issue that there was consensus and momentum building towards it.
Right.
And, you know, you look back at, the first Bush administration, you know, they were open to it and he talked about it regularly. I've seen video clips of him, you know, touting it. I think that there was genuine interest in pushing that forward at the time. And look where we are now. It's just terrifying. But the idea that, you know, in a basic sense, you know, I do obviously feel that people should try to come to the United States legally. I think that's really important. But the reality is that the people that have come here and that are here are the overwhelming majority of them are hardworking, good people just trying to make a good life for themselves. And they came here not to be drug dealers or use the crude term rapists.
Sure.
They came here to better their lives, and because there were jobs here.
Right.
And in all sorts of industries that there were openings and there was a need for that were not being filled necessarily by, you know, natural born, U.S. citizens. And so I think it's ignorant to ignore the reality, the economic reality that these people are, you know, immigrants are contributing to our businesses. They're working in trades. Whether it's landscaping, whether it's the restaurant business, the hotel business, the construction business.
Right.
Could you imagine if, you know, all these people that are here
left.
were just kind of rounded up, not to mention the humanity aspect of it.
Right, right.
Breaking up families and the cruelty.
Look at all the immigrants that are in our healthcare system.
Sure.
I mean, when you go to a hospital or any type medical
hospices place, and nursing homes,
they're absolutely staffed by immigrants.
That's a very good point. Yeah. And you know, they're integrated into, you know, all of our lives, and they're contributing economically. So you know, the idea that you're just going to, you know, could you imagine the construction industry just to name one? In this state alone, the amount of home building that's gone on over the last, you know, 7 years, especially since COVID, you know, the roofers, the concrete, you know, all these companies rely, you know, whether they admit it or not, you know, there's a lot of undocumented labor. And, you know, the truth about it is that we should give these folks acknowledge that they're here,
right.
Acknowledge that they're contributing economically.
Pathway.
Right. We should give them a pathway to citizenship.
And affordable housing too while we're at it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a whole nother thing for sure. But I think, you know, make that pathway, make it difficult. We shouldn't just hand, you know, U.S.'s citizenship out like it's a, balloons at a parade or something. I think they need to earn it, but take them out of the shadows and stop demonizing these folks that are so integrated into our communities and that play such an important role.
We're all immigrants as far as I'm concerned. If you go back to 1700, 1600, everybody except maybe Native Americans, 10,000 years, we're all immigrants. And most of us, in the prior centuries, just walked in.
Say, that's right.
My name is so-and-so. Here I am. And look what the country became and what those immigrants did. And I think
I think you know, what's happening now, you know, there's a lot of shock and awe going on right now.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, stories and everything. And I think we're all very scared about people being snatched off the street.
Yes.
You know, there's people being snatched off university campuses too. That's another
right.
Scary issue. But in terms of just, you know, the immigrant population, they are kind of retrenching to the shadows. They're not spending as much. They're not, you know, and by the way, they do contribute
to
the economy.
They pay Social Security, right?
They are on payrolls. They are literally having Social Security and other
Which
withholdings
they'll never be
withdrawn.
Able to claim, right.
Right. They'll never be able to necessarily benefit from that stuff, but they are contributing constantly. And so I think we need to just kind of be realistic and be more humanistic approach, but local businesses across the state of Florida, I think, are kind of realizing this is actually not very good business.
They better wake up. Yeah.
Yeah. What you're going to round up like half of my workforce, governor, and deport. You know, I don't think that's a very pragmatic approach to the situation we're dealing with.
Yeah. I just heard a statistic yesterday that there were 800 immigrants rounded up in Florida in 4 days.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and it's just the start. And I think that's wrong, but there's other ways to solve that, especially, and they even haven't even made the Dreamers legal yet.
Exactly.
So, there's one problem we have, and we certainly don't have time to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Money and politics, and how to, and campaigns, how to limit that, or, cause I feel like the campaigns are being bought
sure.
with money.
Sure.
And
the Citizens United, you know, that ruling that just kind of opened up the floodgates.
Yes.
You know, that's basically made, you know, the oligarchs and the ultra wealthy, you know, it's given them the ability to buy elections. I mean, Elon Musk, I mean, in my humble opinion, I think bought this last election. You know,
yeah.
he spent $300 million. He bought Donald Trump. And ran a negative, very, very, very regrettable ads in swing states across the
sure.
country. And I think it absolutely made a difference. So he got his just due, and we see what position he got elevated into and his reward for the $300 million he spent. He
amazing.
Bought the presidency.
Can I throw in a few facts
sure.
here that I'm aware of?
Go ahead.
Elon Musk comes from South Africa.
Yeah,
he grew up during apartheid.
Right.
And his whole family was very active in that whole involvement. You're not hearing me?
I'm not hearing you through my earphones, but keep going.
Okay.
I think
we
can hear you.
Okay. Well, anyway, all these policies that he's pursuing right now is the same thing that happened during apartheid, and it's having exactly the same effect. They have no postal services in South Africa. They have no mass transit. Their medical system is very poor
mm-hmm.
because of the apartheid leftover.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
that's exactly what Elon Musk is pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
He's an active member of and his family also were Nazis.
Mm-hmm. They were
devout Nazis.
Right. There's a whole history
yeah.
there and throwing the symbol and it's all pretty disturbing. So
we're talking to Seth Stottlemyre about his book, A Pathway to a New American Future, Our Best Chance for a National Reset. Seth Stottlemyre. Well, there's what part of your book that we don't have time to really go
yeah.
into now that I really liked. You threw in a spiritual element. You wanted people to think a little bit more about their inner selves and their spirituality. Talk just a second about that.
I think just whatever your flavor of religion or spirituality that you gravitate towards, I think everybody should have something. You
yeah.
know, whether it's yoga,
yeah.
whether it's meditation, whether you're a Christian or you practice the Jewish faith or you're a Muslim, or all of the above.
Yeah.
You know, there's ways to kind of tap into all of it. You know, speaking personally, you know, I attend First Presbyterian Church here. My wife and I do, and we're integrated into that, church congregation. And it's a very open, affirming, congregation, and we love it, and we're involved in different community issues, and it just gives you a sense of belonging and a sense of well-being. And you don't have to belong to a church. You can practice your own faith or spirituality at home.
Sure.
Just tying, focusing on something outside of our material self has so much benefit to it. Just focusing on the metaphysical, getting out of your headspace, detaching from commercialism, materialism, and just basically, you know, tapping into the energy in the universe is key. I think if we can get outside of ourselves, a little bit each day and tap into that universal energy, I think it only behooves us in our capacity to relate to each other as citizens, to be more forgiving, to be more open, to be more inclusive. And so I think it is an integral part of kind of the healing that can go on in this country.
Right. And so we have about five more minutes. Seth, what do you have planned now? Just promote this book. What else?
Sure.
What are your plans?
So I'm doing some writing. I'm always doing some writing. I've got my blog, stablegenius.com, and I'm kind of retooling that website right now. So it's not active and up. I've also just launched a Substack. I'm toying around with the idea of launching a podcast, but who isn't thinking about doing a podcast these days?
Right.
So, but I'm thinking about that. But I'm going to continue to write. I've actually got a fiction project that I'm working on right now, a dystopian fiction project, tentatively titled "The Last Festival," and I've written about 100 pages of that. And so I'm working on that. I've kind of ignored it, honestly, for the last 2 years.
It's kind of like it could happen here kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely ties into a lot of, you know, current events and contemporary political goings on. So I'm working on all that stuff. You know, one thing that I don't really touch on in my book, Tom, but I thought I might mention in the last couple minutes that we have here, you know, people – a lot of times are asking me and we're all kind of talking about it. Like, what's next? What do we do? How do we move forward?
Yeah.
How do we kind of fight back? And, you know, 'cause in my book, I've got, you know, touch on a lot of these issues, but not really like necessarily what are we doing in the here and now?
Right.
to kind of like get us through this period of time to be able to actually accomplish some of these goals, and ideas. And I kind of came up with some basic things that I think everybody needs to focus on. Institutions, I think, need to stand together. When universities and law firms and media outlets are targeted and singled out by the Trump administration, and, you know, his minions, they need to kind of stand together and come together, to condemn those actions, and instead of letting the administration pick them off one by one. We've seen these law firms in different situations, and even universities,
right.
Columbia, you know, strike these deals. Like, why are they striking deals? They're just being coerced into doing exactly what
Wants
them to do. Yeah. Stand together, stand firm, because if you strike a deal, it doesn't mean you're safe.
Oh no.
He's gonna come back.
He's got you now.
He's gonna continue to extract, you know, concessions from you and squeeze you like a lemon till there's no juice left. So,
right.
So you might as well take a stand and fight back.
What a great idea.
So I think that's really important. Organizations of all size, institutions of all size. Also, I think we need to continue to stand up for marginalized groups. If we're not standing up for immigrants, if we're not standing up for LGBTQ folks, then we're really undercutting, you know, our moral and ethical ground that we stand on. You know, what's the saying? They came for the.
Right.
I'm going to paraphrase this and totally butcher it. But first, they came for the gays, then they came for the journalists, then they came for the immigrants. And then they came for me.
Exactly.
And nobody was left.
Not right.
So I think we all need to stand together and look out for our most vulnerable communities. I think you need to vote with your wallets and your investment decisions. I think everybody needs to be thinking, what are ways
like
that we can send
them
the boycotts, commercial boycotts. You know, there's lots of ones that have been floating around. I'm not going to go into all them. We've all been reading about them and talking about them. But I think where you buy your stuff is important.
Yes. Remember the bus boycott in Selma, Alabama? You know,
yes.
It worked.
They work. If we come together, it makes a big difference. And then on a local level, there's lots of organizations, I think, that are starting to spring up all around the country. And on a local level, I'll just mention one. You and I kind of talked about it. I won't mention a particular name, there's an organization that's kind of came about. I did a talk actually here at Fogartyville, a book talk, and the organization that came out of it was Advocates for Constitutional Values.
Okay.
And it was co-moderated by a friend of mine. It was a great organization, but it started this organization that's grown to 135. I'm going to get, they're working on their website, so okay. I'll get some information to you. I'll get some information to you because it will be kind of open to be joined by members of the Sarasota community. And it's basically to kind of, you know, focus on the priorities and constitutional values of America.
So this has been a great hour.
On the priorities and constitutional values of America.
So this has been a great hour. We've been talking to Seth Stottlemyre, Stottlemyer. There's no second E.